Welcome to the Today's Leader Podcast. The podcast for the leaders and entrepreneurs of today.
Way to go, guys. Way to go. Keep it going. Good job, guys. All right, Paul, I see you.
All right, John, let's finish on. Coach Carl.
Hey there, it's Coach Curl here, and welcome to the Today's Leader Podcast. This is our final episode before we hit the 300th episode. And it seriously means so much that we've made it to episode 300. Now, I've been privileged to interview some amazing leaders, some amazing marketers, some inspiring and intelligent brand strategists. And today's episode will certainly rank among the best interviews that I've conducted on this podcast. Episode 299 features Stephen Van Bellingham. Now, Stephen is a global thought leader in the field of customer experience. Now, his passion is spreading ideas about the future of what customer experience is. Now, Stephen believes in the combination of common sense, new technologies, and empathetic human touch, playing the long-term game and taking your social responsibility to win the hearts and businesses of customers over and over again. It's an incredibly insightful conversation how all of those areas are blended in to Stephen's view or expertise around customer experience. Now, Stephen has written multiple international best-selling books, including The Conversation Manager, When Digital Becomes Human, Customers, The Day After Tomorrow, The Offer You Can't Refuse. And he's also found time somewhere to write a technology thriller called Eternal. Just so you know, The Offer You Can't Refuse is his latest book, and it was named by Forbes as one of the top 10 must-read business books of 2020. So I just can't wait to bring you Stephen Van Bellingham, and after a word from our sponsors, I know you are going to love it.
The podcast is brought to you by Think and Grow Business, the home of the Think and Grow Business Mastermind. If you're serious about growing your business, get serious and join a mastermind group today. Find out more at thinkandgrowbusiness.com.au.
And it's my pleasure to welcome to the Today's Leader Podcast, Stephen Van Bellingham. How are you, Stephen?
I'm good, Tony. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're from Belgium, you were saying, and usually people that I interview on the podcast are quite often American. So you're one of the very few Europeans that have actually jumped on to be interviewed on the Today's Leader podcast. But that means for me that we're almost truly international. So, Stephen, share with the audience, please. Give me the background. Give me your story.
Sure, with pleasure. So my core focus on everything that I do in my professional life is customer experience. I do research about it, I write books about it, I publish articles, videos, and give keynote presentations all over the world. And my passion is to combine the opportunities of customer experience with the opportunities that new technologies bring. So I always try to describe the future of customer experience, share that to organizations, and my goal is to inspire them to deliver a better and more, let's say, modern form of customer experience.
Coming from a retail background, as I do, I'm really, really aware of the importance of customer experience. But you talk about customer experience for a range of businesses. So it's not just a retail-focused process in which you're talking about. You're talking, from what I can understand, how we can utilize, or the extent of which we utilize, technologies to enhance the customer experience.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And as you say, I think you can apply my ideas in every industry. Doesn't matter if it's B2B or B2C, doesn't matter if it's a large or small organization. The goal is to try to understand how you can bring value to customers, not just today, not just tomorrow, but also in the day after tomorrow, and try to build scenarios for that day after tomorrow. And then you can start to reverse engineer that back to today and see what kind of investments and decisions you need to make today to make your customers happy and to make sure that your customers stay with you until we achieve or until we arrive in that day after tomorrow.
So the customer's changing. Is that a assumption that we can safely make?
Absolutely. I think if you look back to the last, let's say, 15 years, I mean, we had so many evolutions that completely changed customer behavior. It started with the internet. Internet completely changed the way that we looked for information. Now we had mobile. It completely changed the way how we interact with businesses, with each other, eventually how we make purchasing decisions and how we actually buy stuff. Now, if you look to the phase that is ahead of us, it's the phase where artificial intelligence will become more prominent. I think we're all aware of the fact that artificial intelligence is becoming a bigger part of our life and that it's influencing us today already. But if you look to the evolution curve, let's say that the evolution curve of AI looks like a typical S-curve. It starts slowly, then it speeds up, and then it matures. We're now still in the first half of that curve. And if you look back to previous evolutions, we know that customer behavior really starts to change in the second half of the curve. Again, if we compare that with mobile, I don't know if you remember this. When Steve Jobs introduced the iPhone in 2007, he used a sentence to describe the iPhone. He said, "The iPhone will become our life in our pocket." And looking back, that was, you know, that's fantastic how he described it, because today the iPhone is our life in our pocket. But let's be honest, in 2007, we didn't have a clue what he was talking about. I mean, we used the iPhone for gimmicks. The most popular app, I don't know if you remember this, but the most popular app in 2007 for the iPhone, that app was called the iBeer app. Do you remember that one? Then you had to push the button on top of the iPhone, and then you got like a virtual beer. And then you could drink the beer. With the sensors of the phone, it looked like you were drinking the beer. And then you put the phone down, and then the phone burped. And we thought that was the most awesome thing in the world. That's how we used it back in 2007. Now we use it as a life partner. But that evolution, the main part of that evolution, happened in the second half of the curve. Now we're going to see the same thing with artificial intelligence. Today we use it for gimmicks, like we ask Alexa or Google if they want to play a song for us, or we use it as an expensive kitchen timer. But the real impact will happen in the next 10 years when we arrive in the second half of the curve. And again, this will lead to an evolution in customer behavior and customer expectations. And then, you know, to round off my answer to this question, of course, we had COVID in the past couple of months, in the last 15, 16 months. And in my opinion, COVID was an accelerator of many evolutions that were already playing. And it felt like the day after tomorrow just, you know, happened overnight. We suddenly saw this explosion in online meetings. We saw an explosion in e-commerce. We saw an explosion in the usage of online entertainment. But not just digitally, we also saw how people became more concerned about our planet and about the global challenges that we're facing. So the combination of that big digital jump forward, that time machine that we stepped into, combined with a changed mindset towards what we need to do to maintain a high life quality on this planet, that will lead again to new customer expectations in the next couple of years.
It's really quite intriguing, because as you were talking through that, Stephen, I was thinking about all of those people who are really quite reluctant to communicate with, you know, some of the AI that we see online, you know, things like chatbots and, you know, some of the more visible stuff. And based on, well, I'm getting the sense very strongly that that's just scratching the surface in interaction with AI or technology.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. Many people that are listening are probably like, yeah, but it will never work. We've been talking about chatbots and virtual assistants for years, and it still doesn't work. We've been talking about smart fridges, and it's still a dumb fridge, basically. So we're hearing about it, but we're not seeing it. And that's typically something that happens. When you talk about a new technology, it feels like the ocean is very calm, and you see it far out on the horizon, and the horizon always seems to be far away, right? And then something happens in the market, and then overnight, we see a change in behavior. And the companies that can understand that the horizon one day will get close to you, will be in your backyard, those are the ones that are ready for change and that can adapt in a rapid way. Because I'm convinced in the next couple of years, we're going to see multiple evolutions how AI will change customer behavior and customer service. First phase will be behind the scenes. So let's be honest, today if you use a chatbot or a voice assistant, it's not good enough yet. It's really artificial and it's not delivering the quality that we're used to. So today, nothing beats human customer service, right? But behind the scenes, AI is already helping those humans to do a better job. So you have many, many digital applications that are being used, for instance, in contact centers and call centers, where the agent, the human agent gets additional information about the customer, the emotional state of the customer, or where, for instance, the computer already suggests an answer to the agent, and then the agent gets input really quickly, and they can use that and personalize it, but it makes them more productive. That's what's happening now. Humans get support behind the scenes, and we think, wow, human service is increasing rapidly. The phase after that will be that we will, let's say, in the front end, in the user interface, where we're going to see that difference, where chatbots become better, where voice assistants become better. And probably the first place where we're really going to feel the difference is in our home, where indeed, you know, the whole hype and all these stories about IoT and about smart devices, that will actually happen probably in the next 3 to 5 years. And that will change the way that we live. And that's going to be the first place where we're really going to feel the impact of artificial intelligence. And organizations that think about those possibilities today can start to prepare for that future.
One of the visible areas that I see AI helping businesses at the moment, and when you're talking about the back end, I was thinking about our cloud accounting software. So whatever brand that people are using out there, our accounting software drawing the feeds from the bank, and then many of them are now making assumptions or making suggestions or recommendations on how to process some of those transactions based on what you've been doing previously or based on what it's picking up. So when you're talking about AI, and you know, so many people start thinking about the Terminator movies when we start talking about AI and whatnot. So that ability for AI to actually learn, is that something that you see will be continuing of benefit as we move through those stages over the next 10 or so years?
Yeah, in my opinion, the biggest challenge for organizations will be to figure out a way how to combine those learning and predictive capabilities that AI has with the typical human capabilities that the technology doesn't have. So if you look at artificial intelligence, probably the learning part where you refer to will become a predictive service tool. And the biggest power of AI in customer service is to solve a problem before a customer even knows that there's a problem. That's one of the big benefits, where they can anticipate two problems because they know that we have a certain pattern and they can solve the problem. So imagine that you're driving to the airport. There's an accident on the way somewhere on your road, on the route that you're going through. You don't know that yet, but the machine knows it. Machine knows that you're going to miss your flight, and they rebook you, and then they tell you, "Hey, Tony, we put you on the next flight because you're going to miss the one that you booked, but everything is being taken care of." That's faster than real time. Or you can also anticipate in a proactive way, saying, "Okay, I know that you have a routine. Every morning you leave your house at 7:20 a.m. and then you go to the office. And we know that you stop at Starbucks to get a coffee." Well, what you see now, for instance, in China, that they try to make sure that if they know that you want to have your coffee and you leave at 7:20, that coffee will be delivered every day at 7:20 at your doorstep so that you don't have to do the effort anymore. So they predict what you will do and they change their behavior to make your life more easy. And that can be done when you have a certain routine. And many people think, "Yeah, but I don't have routines." But that's the illusion that we have about ourselves. The truth is that, for instance, 80% of the things that you eat and drink in your house are the same month after month after month. So once you have that pattern, they can start to predict, and they can actually bring the groceries you need before you're missing them out. That's for instance, where the power of AI is, predicting in a personalized way. And that's really cool. But then that's challenge number one. Challenge number two is then figuring out how humans can add value in that automated life. And to do that, you need to figure out what humans can do that machines cannot. And yeah. and for me, there's only one element, one typical human characteristic that we have that machines will never have. And that is empathy. Don't talk about creativity. That ship has sailed. Computers can be more creative than humans. But it's empathy, yeah. That instant capability that we have to change our behavior if we see that a certain person is in a certain mood, or if that emotion is changing, we see that, we feel that, and we change our behavior. And empathy is probably the most important human skill that you're going to need to boost your customer experience in the next couple of years. And the organization that manages to combine both, that predictive, faster, and real-time yeah. mindset with an empathic mindset, those will have a fantastic customer relation.
You've given me real insight here, Stephen, because even with that predictive capability, every morning when I pick up the iPhone, I'm now getting a predictive sort of a thing from the iPhone saying these are apps you usually open first up. So it's given me the choice of two or three that are my morning go-to. So, and when you start putting it into the context of this will be just become more and more to the enhancement of ourselves, I can certainly visualize that. So I'm very interesting. So you've written quite a number of books, haven't you?
Five management books so far.
And your last one, 2020, The Offer You Can't Refuse, you were named by Forbes as one of the 10 must-read business books. So what? To tell me a little bit then about The Offer You Can't Refuse. What was that book centered around, and why has it had such a high regard?
Yeah, I was extremely happy with that article of Forbes in which they mentioned the book. That was like... I was, I think, the only European author in there, so I was really, really proud. And yeah. I think The Offer You Can't Refuse is very timely. I think it's a story, of course, about the future of customer experience, but linked back to everything that happened to the planet in the last couple of months. Even though my research was done before the pandemic started, but some of those trends really accelerated, so that made my story more timely. I created a model in the book in which I invite companies to invest in four different layers of the customer relation, because those four layers bring value today to the modern customer. And the first layer is very simple. It's having a good product at a good price with good service. That's still, a very important need that humans have. If you want to do business, you want to work with a company that brings good product, good service, good price. But it's the minimum demand. If you don't have that, you cannot even start. What we've seen in the last couple of months is that the minimum demand has increased. People today also expect digital convenience. Digital convenience has become the norm. It has become a commodity. If you have it, fine. If you don't have it, your company gets in trouble. But it becomes really, really hard to positively differentiate yourself with digital convenience. That was something you could do in the past 10 years. That's something you will not be able to do in the next 10 years. It's just part of the minimum today. So that's your foundation. And then I work with two dimensions that help you to differentiate yourself towards your customer. And the first one is what I called a partner in life strategy, where you look for ways how to add value in the day-to-day life of customers, where you try to change the life of your customers in a positive way, where it's no longer about how can we sell our products, but where it's about the human behind the customer. And I don't talk about customer journeys in that specific component. I talk about life journeys. It's about understanding that every customer has like a movie of their life in their head, with things they hope, things they dream about, their fears, their ambitions. And the better you understand that movie, the better you can create services or can anticipate to certain things that they value in their life, and you can become a partner in their life. And here, empathy is your core capability. So that's one dimension how you can make a difference. A second dimension how you can make a difference today is what I call changing your world. As I mentioned before, there are many global challenges that we're facing. It's not just the biggest healthcare crisis of our generation. It's also about a fight against racism and discrimination. It's about a more and more urgent climate problem. There are many global challenges, and organizations can become part of the solution. And the goal shouldn't be changing the world, because, I mean, a company in Belgium where I live, maybe a company in Australia where you live, it's not that easy to change the world for a small retailer.
Yeah.
But they can change their world. You can change your world. You can use the strengths that you have, leverage those, and have an impact on the community that you serve in a way that goes beyond you and that customer, but in a way that it contributes to the entire society and the entire community. And that's the top of the model. So then you have basically four layers: good product, service price, digital convenience, partner in life, and changing your world. All four of those dimensions bring value to the customer today. But if you manage to bring those four together in one storyline, one experience for the customers, that's the point when you create an offer they can't refuse.
Just allow me some time to digest all of that. That's just awe-inspiring, to be honest. So do we run the risk of taking it too far? Like, is there a tipping point where we move from potentially that enhancement of people's lives to intrusion into people's lives, for example?
Yeah, very good. Very good question. We don't want to create intrusion in people's lives. Partner in life, for instance, I get many questions about that. Partner in life doesn't mean that you're disturbing people all the time with all your crazy ideas on what you can do. I have a metaphor that I use.
Yeah.
Imagine rhinos in the bush in Kenya. Rhinos, beautiful animals, but nature made a mistake. Nature made the assumption that a rhino would have no natural enemies, because if a lion bumps into a rhino, the lion will look at it and will be like, no, I'm having the zebra for lunch. I'm going to leave the rhino alone. So no natural enemies. Because of that, nature didn't give all the premium features to the rhino. So his eyesight and his smelling capabilities are rather low. Because of that, a rhino is an easy target for poachers. And nature didn't think about poachers when they created the planet. So that was a mistake. And because of that, the rhino is an easy target. But thank God for the rhino. The rhino has a partner in life. The little birds that travel on the back of the rhino, they're called oxpeckers. They don't just eat the parasites from the back of the rhino. They also function as an alarm system, because those birds, they have great eyesight and they can spot humans from a far distance. And when they see humans, those oxpeckers, they make a different sound. And the rhino can hear that sound. And then the rhino knows, oh my God, there are humans around. And then the rhino takes off. Well, that is, in my opinion, what a partner in life should all be about. How can you be the oxpecker on the back of the rhino? Because an oxpecker is always around without being intrusive. The rhino doesn't even feel that that bird is on its back. It's around without being intrusive, and it adds value in a proactive way at the exact right moment. And that's what you need to do as a partner in life. And then you bring value to a customer. You don't want to be the fly around the tail of a horse or around the tail of a cow that the customer has to, you know, is being bothered by you all the time. That's not what you want to be. You want to be the oxpecker on the back of the rhino.
Be the oxpecker, not the fly around the tail. That's a really great analogy. Where does ethics sit within all this? Is there an ethics platform that we need to be mindful of?
Absolutely. When you think about the top of the model, changing your world, instantly when I talk about this, people think, sustainability. We need to do something about sustainability. And that's of course, very important. In my opinion, playing your role in sustainability will very quickly become a minimum demand. That if you don't do it, that people think you're a terrible company. And if you do mind climate change and everything, that is just something that a decent company does. So I don't think you will be able to differentiate yourself with that in the next couple of years. Differentiation will be on the social level, where you look for social engagement that you can, you know, use your strengths in the local community to do something that makes a difference. That's one side. The second one is the ethical part. Especially if we look to the field of new technologies, especially if we look at the potential of artificial intelligence, the ethical guidelines will become more important than ever. Because, you know, the marketing people and business leaders are very nice people, but what happens if you give them a tool that is so powerful that they can create certain interfaces, certain algorithms for their benefit in a way that the customer will never know what is happening behind the scenes? Because this is often the case, and the scary part about AI, it's not transparent for us. We don't know what's happening. We don't know how it works. And we know that companies will make machines that lie. Look at Volkswagen. I mean, the whole scandal that they had, they made a machine that lied. They told the machine, if they open up the hood and they do some experiments, you need to lie. And then the machine said, sure, no problem, I will lie. So I think that we need high ethical standards there. Probably we're going to need government support there. Not in a way that the European Union likes to do things, because that's too regulatory and it's limiting the power of innovation. We need to figure out a way how we can still benefit from the power of innovation, but in a way that it's been done in a decent way for organizations. There's a company in Scandinavia, in the Nordics, an AI company that works for the oil industry. And they have this software that they're testing in certain gas stations. And this is what it does. You get there with your car, and they scan your license plate. And your license plate contains a lot of data about who you are. It has your address. And your address tells you about your social status in life. And if they combine your address with the brand of the car and the type of car that you have, they can make a pretty good assumption about how far you're up on the wealth curve of a nation or a neighborhood. And based on that information, they personalize the prices. So they don't publish the prices anymore in a transparent way. You see the price on your smartphone, and you pay with your smartphone. So if you drive up in, let's say, a very expensive SUV and you live in a very nice neighborhood, you may be paying 10% more than someone who's taking gas on the other side of the station that lives in a less nice neighborhood. And some people say, that's great. It's sharing wealth. Other people are like, but it's not because I make more money that I want to pay 10% more for everything. That doesn't feel. Yeah. We have taxes for that. So those kind of things are scary and are not good for the customer. And we need ethical standards for that, or we're going to end up in big trouble. Sometimes I feel that AI could become like the temptation island of marketing people. And that's never a good thing if you put marketing people on temptation island.
Well, Gary Vaynerchuk is one that where I first heard this next statement, and that marketing people ruin everything. So when there's a good thing, there's always going to be a marketer somewhere that wants to take it to the next level. And that exact example that you just provided, I find quite frightening, to be honest, that there's going to be some different prices charged based on what the AI or the technology can pick up on you. And I think one of the greatest challenges that we face, not just with technology, but I guess within the world, is that we've got a great power that's being held by a very small number of, say, big tech companies, right? So we're seeing the algorithms, we're seeing some posts just get blocked or put some fact-checking onto it. And we've got, people on both sides of the political spectrum that are being deplatformed based around, you know, whatever it is that they've been posting. So I think that concept of getting guidelines and standards and trying to create a ethical standard for the greater good, because what I might think is the greater good may be different from what someone else is thinking is the greater good. And then if we've got an algorithm that's blocking, maybe 50% of the news or the videos or whatever, that could lead to some real manipulation around, you know, not just myself, but general population. So I guess that's a little bit of my fear in relation to where we go with AI and to what extent it can be used to create an opinion, a narrative, or stuff like that.
Yeah, I fully agree with you. I think that's the biggest threat that we're facing right now. And I also agree with the fact that there's so much power in just a handful of organizations. We had so much centralization of power in the past 10 years that it's not good anymore for society. And I'm disappointed. I'm sometimes a big fan of those companies because I think they're doing great stuff and they're reinventing customer experience in a way that goes beyond anything that we've seen, and they're so innovative and it goes so fast. So I admire that part of who they are. But I'm also disappointed in the fact that the leadership of those organizations doesn't proactively come up with a solution together. Why doesn't Mark Zuckerberg want more transparency about who is investing in Facebook campaigns? Right now in certain parts of Europe, we know that there are campaigns against COVID vaccination supported by other nations trying to slow down the vaccination process in certain European countries by sharing fake news. And certain people are more receptive to that than others. But that's a threat to our economy, about our healthcare system. And this is happening. We know it's happening.
Yeah.
Facebook knows that this is happening. Why aren't they solving this? I'm disappointed in that. I think if they want to, become the good in the world, and if they want to achieve their mission, connecting people in a positive way, they need to be much stronger in their reaction against all these fake algorithms, because it's a threat to them as well. I mean, if we don't trust the information anymore that we get there, one day, sooner or later, it's going to be enough for a lot of people, and then we may leave, then we may, just overnight go somewhere else, and then it's also game over for them. So basically, we have the same goal. We want to use Facebook in a friendly way, and they want to stay in business. So I'm disappointed that we don't see more leadership on that terrain.
Yep. And it's that concept of distrust that is really becoming evident, that people aren't necessarily trusting of, we hear the statements around fake news and fake media, and then we're hearing and seeing whatever the algorithms are being presented to us. So that distrust factor of the AI journey, I agree with you. Big tech have done some wonderful things. And I struggle to think of a person that's not on Facebook, for example. So great for connecting, great for socials. How do they harness that power to make sure that they're doing the right things so that, A, both sides of a story potentially need to be heard so that people can make some valid judgments? So.
Yeah, well, I don't know if that was in the news in Australia last week, but last week in the Netherlands, just the country north of Belgium, the government had the assumption that they were calling with someone from the Russian government to discuss the situation in Russia. But afterwards, they discovered that it was an avatar that they were talking with. So it were just other people, they don't know who, but people with bad intentions that tried to get some quotes from the Dutch government against the Russian government. And, this is not just on Facebook. This is a high-level secret conversation, and they were fooled by it. And those are not, you can say, how are they fooled? But these people are not idiots. I mean, this technology is becoming so good that if you don't know the people personally and you have a meeting and you think, okay, this is a closed meeting room, we made this appointment, you have the belief that you're talking to a real human. I trust the fact that I'm talking to you, but we've never met before, so I don't know. Yeah. So maybe you or me were an avatar and the other one doesn't even know that. If you think about that, that's extremely scary. So we're going to need probably technology to fight the technology, to have like a real human scan. So I know, it's Tony. He's real. Thank God he's a real human. It's not just an avatar that they've sent to me here.
Yeah, Sam Harris has talked about that quite often in his podcast series. And I saw on Twitter just the other week, someone had created a deep fake of Sam Harris talking. So, and tagged him in it and said, this is what you've been talking about. So, yeah, there is some real concerns. And I can understand it. Was that part of the reason why that compelled you, I guess, to jump into the customer experience? What was the deep-seated reason that brought you down this track?
A number of things. First of all, I grew up with my parents, obviously, and they had a photography store in Belgium. And we always had lunch together, dinner together. I was living basically in the back office of the store, so I was part of the action. And I saw that every single day, and I didn't know it back then, but later on I discovered that my parents were extreme customer-centric, and they came up with innovative tools. My dad was one of the first small businesses that had a customer database and did one-on-one marketing. And I'm talking about 1987 or something now. So I even made that database for him when I was like 13 years old. And I thought it was the most normal thing in the world. It was only later that I discovered, hey, they're doing something really cool here. And so the customers and being attentive towards them as part of my DNA. And then I was very fortunate. I have an aunt, my dad's sister, actually. She married with an American. And they live in the Bay Area, close to San Francisco. And I had the pleasure to spend almost all my teenage summers and student summers in Silicon Valley, basically. So I lived there. I met a lot of their friends. And I became intrigued by the optimism that you feel in Silicon Valley and about the yes, we can mentality that you have there. I went to school there. I went to Berkeley. And I really got excited about it. And that's how I fell into that technology part. And then I combined those two. And that's how it all got started. And then, you know, it's like a number of decisions along the way that brought me where I am today. But it's basically what happened in my teenage years that is the foundation of what I do today.
Excellent. Who's inspired you in your leadership journey?
Oh, there's so many. First of all, my parents. The way that they've run their business is probably the biggest inspiration. It was a small business. It's my mom and my dad together with two or three employees. But the decisions that they made were always, we're going to be innovative. We're going to be the first ones with this machine because then we can create faster service. We're going to work with computers. Then we can do this. And when something went wrong in their business, they always chose for the customer. That's what they did. They didn't worried if it would cost them money in the short term. They were always playing the long term game. Yeah. And I think that's still for me the biggest inspiration because it's what I do. I don't care about the short term. I think about the long term game. Of course, I hope to get short term results, but I have zero expectations about the short term. I have all my eggs in the long term basket. I know what I want to do, and that's my belief that if I do the right things today, that eventually I will end up where I want my journey to go through. And my parents were an inspiration for that. Next to that, I had the pleasure to work with a professor in a business school here in Belgium. His name is Rudy Munart, and he was my first boss. And he was my professor in my last year at the university, and he hired me to do research for him. But he threw me in the deep end of the pool. So I graduated. 1 month later, I was working for him. And then he said, now you need to teach here in this business school this class. And I said, well, many of those guys that are in that class were my fellow students, my fellow beer drinking mates last year. He said, I know, but now you're working here. They're a student and you're going to be the teacher and you have 2 weeks to prepare that. And I was so scared, but he let me do my thing. He coached me. And the first time it was a crash and burn. It was terrible. It gave me feedback, and then he said, okay, now we're going to go to a different audience. I have this big client here, 3M, and I have a big consulting gig there, and you need to do some interviews with their senior leadership, and then you need to make a presentation and present that to the board in a couple of weeks from now. And I said, Rudy, I just had a crash and burn. He said, yeah, but you learned, and this is now how we're going to do it, and this time it's going to work. And I worked really hard on that, and then together we went to 3M, to their senior leadership. And I presented, and I suddenly, for the first time, felt that those people were actually listening and that I had an impact there. And that was the first time that I felt that, and I was only 2 months out after I graduated. And the fact that he threw me in the deep end, but that he helped me to get through that, not too much. He didn't hold my hand. He just coached me, and I had to do it myself. But the fact that he had that trust in me, and that I then eventually achieved what he wanted me to do, that was such an important step in my career. I worked with him and for him a year and a half. Then he moved on to another university. I moved on to a startup company. And I think that was, you know, such a pleasure, and I'm so thankful that I worked with him. But I mean, along the way, I had inspirational leaders and coaches that I had the pleasure to work with every single step in my career. Every step in my career, I looked for someone that I could learn from and that could, you know, grow me personally and could grow me professionally. And very thankful that I had the opportunity to work with a lot of them. And next to that, I have leaders that I work with personally. Next to that, I find a lot of inspiration of people that I work with professionally now and then, that I have the pleasure to interview, that I have the pleasure to work with. You mentioned Gary Vaynerchuk. I had the pleasure to work with him a couple of times. And he has been a source of inspiration for me in the last couple of years. And you know, I had the pleasure to spend a few days with him. We had the pleasure to... I run this company called Snack Bites. It's one of the startups that I created together with one of my best friends, Sam, and we worked with Gary on that. And then Sam had the opportunity to follow him for a week at VaynerMedia, and we learned so much from that we could implement in our company. It made our company more successful. Last month, I had the pleasure to work with Seth Godin on a project. And I've always been a fan of him. I've met him two times before, but now it was a more in-depth partnership. I learned so much. I mean, also, even though it's just a day or a couple of hours, I try to, you know, take that opportunity and learn so much from those people that I look up to, that I know I can learn from. And then I try to take that opportunity, you know, to the fullest to make sure that learning moment is just a magical moment that takes me again to the next level. So I'm very open for coaching and inspirational people.
So taking the opportunity is obviously part of that whole process with yourself. And one of the things that many leaders don't unfortunately get from their direct reports or the people that are leading them is that concept of trust and faith in them in stepping up or stepping into the role. And that can be absolutely demoralizing for a leader that's ambitious, that's career-oriented, that really wants to make a difference. But without that support, it's really challenging for them to do that. So I hope that people listening took a lot away from that. I mean, just the fact that you've worked with some huge names there is just amazing, and you've taken the opportunity to be a student and really take that on deck. So there's some real... gold there, Stephen. So thank you very much for sharing. So now I'm going to flip it a little bit. So tell me about those times, or tell me about your relationship that you have with failure.
I have a pretty positive relation with failure. The crazy thing is if people ask me, did you have any failures? My first reaction is to say, No, I didn't have any failures. But if I then think deeper, I had so many failures. But when I look back to my career, in my memory, there are no failures. We had this crazy thing once, Tony. I started another business called Nextworks, and Nextworks organizes inspiration tours where we take executives from big companies and we take them to Silicon Valley, to New York, we take them to China, to Singapore, to Dubai. And we show them what's going on. So I'm then like the tour guide, and I during that week we take people to 20 organizations, and we have a first row seat to see what's happening there. Both big name companies, small names, thought leaders. Really cool stuff. And during one of these tours at the end, during the last dinner, we had some wine and it was a very cozy evening. Someone said, you know, guys, this was a great week, but let's be honest, we won't be able to do everything we heard this week in our own companies. So why don't we start a company together with this group of 25 people? Why don't we decide that right now, here today, in this restaurant in Seattle, it was. And we were cheering. We said, yeah, we're going to start a company. So we all put like 2,500 euros on the table virtually, like on a piece of paper. We came back. We started the company. And, you know, to make a long story short, suddenly we had the idea. And I'm talking about 2012 right now. We had the idea to make a smart bracelet for senior people to make sure that they could live longer in their houses, and that it was like a safety bracelet to make sure that caregivers could get to them when they fall or when something is wrong. And this was before Apple Watches or Fitbits even were part of the market. And then we raised money. The what was it? 75,000 euros became $500,000. And then we said, we need more money. So we went to the newspaper in Belgium. We said, hey, guys, this is a group of entrepreneurs that is doing this. Who wants to join? Because we're going to make the life of older people better in our country and beyond. So like 40 or 50 entrepreneurs joined. And suddenly we had 5 million euros to start this company. And we actually created the bracelet. And there was so much excitement. And then eventually it became a failure. We weren't fast enough. We the product was too expensive. In the meanwhile, Apple watches started to come to market cheaper. Apple as a competitor is not always a good thing if you're a small startup in Belgium. So, but the product still exists today, but it never became what we hoped it would be. So it's a failure. It's we didn't achieve our goal, but that journey was such a blast. We all lost money. But the journey was so fantastic, and it was such an amazing story that for me, it doesn't feel like a failure. But objectively, it is a failure. That's like a big thing that failed. Sometimes I put videos on my YouTube channel of which I think this is the best video I ever made. People are going to love it. It's going to have 10,000 of views, and then it stops at 500. Big failure. Mm. But then I'm like, okay, probably the content isn't good enough. I have to rethink it. I have to learn. I have to see what I did wrong. So I can improve that. For me, it doesn't feel like a failure, that micro thing. Yeah. It feels like a real life experiment that I have to take to the next level. So I had many failures, but usually until now, maybe it's because they didn't have a huge impact on me. I don't know. But until now, they don't feel like a failure. They feel like part of the journey I'm going through.
So it's always in my mind, and once again, you've just reaffirmed this, it's about learning from where it doesn't necessarily go right and taking that onto our next part of the journey, whatever that's going to be, whether that's a new organization, a new company, new people, learning what actually we took away from the perception of failure. So, and I guess one of the reasons why I always ask that question is because I really want people to understand that failure is not something that stops us. It should be something that we learn from and keeps us moving forward. So, and once again, your stories just support that. So during, what book, because leaders are readers, what books had the biggest impact on you?
Oh, there are many. But, you know, if I can go back in history, the book that really had maybe the biggest impact on me is a book that I read in 1999. It's a book written by Geoffrey Moore. It's called Crossing the Chasm. It's an old book. It talks about how customer expectations are different if they belong to a different part of the adoption curve. Basically saying to companies, if you launch a new product, the way that you market it to innovators and early adopters, and the success that you get from that launch could be the reason for failure if you use that same strategy if you want to go to the early majority, because that the mindset of those people is different. So you need a different communication, you need maybe different features on the product, but the success reasons in the first part of your launch will be completely different in the second part of your launch. There's a chasm between that. And it's an old book. If you would read it, I mean, the examples are probably outdated like crazy, but the philosophy behind it, I'm sure it still works today. And it's such a simple model that he has that you think, of course. And I was working on a lot of research back then when I was reading it. I was doing my thesis in my last year of the university. And suddenly for me, that was like, oh man, this guy just described what I tried to do in such a simple and strong model. And I need, you know, 75 scientific papers to get the same thing. And then I realized the strength of very simple models to explain things and to make sure that people will copy-paste your terminology. And basically, if I look to the books that I've written so far, that's what I try to do. I try to bring a very simple model, like the one I explained here in this podcast about the offer you can't refuse. It's very simple, but it brings together a lot of the things that are happening right now. And because of its simplicity, it becomes actionable. And I saw that back in 1999, and that had an impact on all the work that I did. So that one had a big impact on me. But there's so many others. I mentioned Seth Godin. One of his recent books is This Is Marketing. And Seth has written more than 20 books on marketing. And this was probably number 18, I think. And I thought it was so powerful. If some people can be cynical and say, yeah, what was new? For me, what was new is that he just, in 5 steps, explained what marketing was all about and what you need to focus on. And I've been in marketing my entire career for more than 20 years. And I read that book, This is Marketing, and I thought, this is so simple. But I learned a lot from it. I changed basically the way that I do my own marketing because of his book. Yeah, wow. And then you know it's power. If a book brings you a new idea, it's a good book. But if it makes you change your behavior, it's a fantastic book. And This is Marketing made me change my behavior. So I'm very thankful that Seth wrote it in that way. And again, it's very simple. But that's the most powerful thing to do.
5 steps, right? So, and once again, I work with a lot of small businesses who are absolutely petrified of marketing. You know, whether it's seeing a return on investment or getting the message right or doing the work to understand who the customer is. And if there's a way, and if they're listening, please, I'd encourage you, have a look at This is Marketing by Seth, because that may be the impetus that you need to actually get a real good grip around your own business marketing. So Stephen, we're coming towards the end. You've been an amazing guest. Out of everything that you've accomplished over the last couple of years, what is it indeed that you are most proud of?
Professionally, you mean?
Yeah. It can be personally. So many people say their kids and their partners.
Of course. I mean, that's the answer that is the most important part. I have a wonderful wife, 2 children, and of course I'm very proud of them. Without saying if that part of your life isn't in balance, then you cannot fully enjoy the professional moments of glory. Yeah. So I'm very fortunate. I have a wonderful family, and we've been together for a very long time. So that is certainly something that is in place, and I'm very thankful about. If I look to what I'm very proud of, is that I'm always proud if an organization that I don't know reaches out and tells me, hey, Stephen, we've read your book, or we saw this YouTube video, or we saw a small video on Instagram, and it inspired us, and we changed something towards our customers, and it was a great success, and we wanted to share that. I often get emails like that. And that makes me proud. It makes me happy because, you know, then you realize that the story just travels without me being present. And then I think this is so cool that someone in South Africa actually ordered this book on Amazon, read it, and it has an impact on their personal life or on their business. Those small stories that reach me, they really make my day. I have this in my mailbox. I have a separate folder that I made, Feel Good Mails, and I save all of them. I don't delete them. I have all of those mails that were sent to me in the last 10 years. I still have every single one of them, and it makes me so happy to look at that collection. In the meanwhile, it's more than thousands of emails, and having that collection, that makes me really not just proud but happy. That gives me a great feeling.
Absolutely. I can just imagine. So, is there anything that I haven't asked you, Stephen, that I should have?
No. I loved your questions. I think they were great, and it was a pleasure to speak with you. I'm a huge fan of Australia. My last big trip before the pandemic started was to Australia with my family in the summer of 2019. We spent 5 weeks in your beautiful country.
Okay.
And it's always fantastic to speak with people from Australia. And this is not just because I'm talking to you, but I had the feeling I've been in a lot of countries, but I had the feeling that people in Australia were the most authentic, friendly people I have ever met. And that was such a warm feeling when I was traveling through your country that I have so many great memories. So I was just excited getting up this morning that I could speak with you. So thank you for having me.
No worries. How can people connect with you, Stephen?
I'm active on all social networks, so they can go to YouTube. There's a lot of content on YouTube. If they like my work, they will find hundreds of videos. So it's just youtube.com/my name, Stephen van Bellegem. Instagram, if they want to have short form content, I'm on Instagram. Just my name, Stephen van Bellegem. Follow me on LinkedIn. They can, if they want to reach out, they can send me a LinkedIn message, or they can go to my website. They can find my email address there. My website is stephenvanbellegem.com. So I'm everywhere, and I'm very active and very responsive.
Excellent. Stephen, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the Today's Leader podcast. Thank you very much for investing in Today's Leaders. And let's stay in contact. I found that absolutely fascinating. So thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Happy to stay in touch. And it was a pleasure to be part of your show.
Join the group of people impacted by Seriously Simple Stuff to Get You Unstuck, the first book by Tony Coach Curl. Available at Amazon, Tony's Simple Stuff provides the tool for people to master your life and aspirations. 20% of every book sold supports Carter's cause.
Well, now it's time for Tony's 2 cents. Now, what did I take away from our discussion? Well, either the Terminator is coming, or maybe it's not. But what we do know is that enhancement of our lives are already here through the use of technology. That's absolutely true. There's not too many people that can argue that it's not here. Now, customer experience via the continuing use of AI is where Stephen's focus is, and it's where our conversation was. And that conversation was fascinating. But in many cases, for business owners, business leaders, or managers, the use of AI and technology is already relevant, particularly relevant behind the scenes. We see it in, you know, simple things like our online banking, our online accounting, and, you know, even in our everyday use of our social media platforms, the algorithms behind the scenes are fundamentally changing what it is that we see based on our engagement. But let's quickly chat around the implication that COVID has placed on the rise of tech. Now, Stephen rightly pointed out that COVID has in fact been an accelerant. The accelerant for the use of tech to further enhance our lives. Now, whether this is in the work environment, in the way that we do our shopping, in the entertainment space, in our productivity and organizational space, the list just goes on and on and on, where technology is enhancing our lives. Now, that's the reality. The gate has been opened, and that particular horse has bolted. Now, why is this important for this moment in time? Now, for consumers, it's going to be mostly a pleasurable experience. They'll continue to see and experience this change, with some notable exceptions. Now, what Stephen was talking about, the use of AI and technology determining the price of petrol that you would pay when you went to the petrol or the gas station, which is particularly concerning for me, as in all of a sudden we've got a piece of technology determining who can pay more and who can pay less. But the key for the audience is that business owners will feel this change. Business owners will feel this change. Consumers most likely will continue to embrace and see the change, but business owners will feel the change. So let me explain that. If a business owner aren't on board with technology, they've got their head in their sand hoping that it goes away, maybe they're not agile or looking forward, maybe they've got enough on their plate that they're just working day to day and trying to get through a day and make it to the next day. You know, the reality for those business owners or business leaders or business managers is that they will experience disruption through this accelerant rise of technology. As I said, the gate's open, the horse is bolted. So if a business or a leader or a owner isn't on board with technology and enhancing their business operations, efficiencies and experiences with the use of technology, mate, your competitors have already, because the gate's open, the horse is bolted. And if you do embrace technology, there's no doubt that you will feel the momentum. You know, like a wave on the way to shore, but only when you catch it. Because if you fall off the back of the wave, you have no momentum. But if you catch the wave, you have momentum. So the question has to be, are you on the wave or behind the wave? The world as we know it, or that we knew it back in 2019, is no longer relevant. So the question I have to pose on Tony's Two Cents is, what steps do you take to remain relevant? What an amazing conversation. All Stephen's links, his YouTube channel, his Instagram, his website are all available on the show notes. So please make sure you're checking out his YouTube channel. Is something absolutely amazing. So what he does with his YouTube videos is really critically important for anyone in business wanting to enhance the customer experience. Now, next week, I'm going to be celebrating our 300th episode by sharing my personal top 10 learnings that I've had with some of our amazing expert guests. You won't want to miss this one. There will be some surprises in this field of the top 10 personal learnings. So it will land on Thursday as normal. Our episode 300 episode will be there with my top 10 personal learnings. I really hope that you subscribe because you don't want to miss this one. Now is the time for you to take control of your leadership growth in the disruptive world we navigate. Our aim is to help you become the leader that you're meant to be today. Now, if you're looking to build leadership skills, check out Today's Leader website at todaysleader.com.au. Our website showcases our podcast and our magazine, and we're pleased to say our masterminds are now available, supported by, of course, our network site. So Today's Leader is a collective mindset for the leaders and entrepreneurs of today, forging the path of success for tomorrow, the mindset to make a difference, the ability to make, create an impact. Think and Grow Business hosts the Today's Leaders, and we are pleased to say we now have two international mastermind groups going at the moment, which I'm pretty stoked about. So even though it's a .com.au address, we do cater for all of our listening audience. And 25%, I believe, of our listening audience is based in the US. And we've actually got quite a large listening contingent in Pakistan and India. So, and as I said, we've got our first international masterminds up and running now. So I'm really, really stoked about that. The mindset to make a difference, the ability to create an impact. Think and Grow Business, of course, hosts our Today's Leader Masterminds. Think and Grow Business, where we focus on personal, professional, and business growth. Book your free 30-minute discovery call at thinkandgrowbusiness.com.au. It's available right from the homepage. Don't forget, you are standing stronger, braver, and wiser. Don't forget the golden rule. You know what that is. Don't be an arsehole. I'll see you next week for our episode 300. Bye for now.